Welcome to the series Who Am I, sponsored and run by the IBA. As you have seen in the announcement, the series aims to learn from and to be inspired by some of the most outstanding and exciting life stories of colleagues and practitioners of the legal profession. We will learn in this series about their motivations, their drives and dreams, but also their failures and struggles along the way. We will hear about their worries, but mainly their dreams and visions of the future of the legal profession. But first and foremost, we will get to know the human being behind the facts and achievements and understand and be inspired by their vocation. Today, I'm pleased to have Mark Ellis, the Executive Director of the IBA, as my guest in this series, Who Am I? Mark, as we all know, is an outstanding international criminal law expert. Having studied at the Florida State University, received 2 Fulbright scholarships, completed research grants to the European Union, and received in 2010 his PhD in international law from the King's College in London. He has completed many issues, to just name a few. He is an adjunct professor of the Florida State University College of Law, where he teaches international human rights and international criminal law. He received many awards, such as the ABA's World Order and Law Award, and by the United States Department of the recognition of lifelong commitment to the rule of law and contributions to international legal reform and many others. Mark worked also as legal advisor to the Independent International Commission on Kosovo and was appointed by the OECD to advise on the creation of the Serbian War Criminal Tribunal. As you know, he was also involved in the trial of Saddam Hussein and is assistant counsel to the ICC, the International Criminal Court. But who is Mark Ellis as a person? What defines him? What made him the outstanding legal practitioner and executive director of the world's largest association of bars and lawyers, of the IBA? We will find out today. My name is Jörg Menzer. I'm the chair of the section of public and professional interest of the IBA, the SPPI, and I welcome all viewers. Mark, how are you this morning?
Good, Jörg. It's great to be here and great to be here with you. So what a great opportunity to spend some time with you this morning. So thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you. As you know, when we prepared our discussion, we had the idea to talk about general principles of your drivers, and I think we will get to that. However, I saw that this morning you already commented in the Times, one of the most prestigious newspapers, about the Ukrainian crisis, and obviously also Sternford Moyo and yourself condemned already this crisis. Maybe you can give us, before we go back to you as a person, the first impression, the first impact to you as a criminal lawyer.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite striking to me that you and I are sitting here in London, England, in Europe, and we're witnessing a full attack, military attack, a war that is now being conducted by Russia. And I have to say that for me, even though I have experienced that earlier in the former Yugoslavia, I'm not sure I would have ever thought that in my lifetime we would be witnessing this type of conflict again in the heart of Europe. And so, I, as you just alluded to, I wrote an op-ed piece this morning in the London Times, and of course the IBA has been absolutely on target in speaking out against this very aggressive act, and in essence doing what I think lawyers should do, and reminds the international community about the importance of law and principles of international law. And this is one of the most egregious violations of law that we've seen in many, many years.
Thank you. I think we cannot agree on more, and we're all shocked also by the threats that are still out there. But let's come back to you, because I think this statement you issued this morning says already a lot of your vocation and who you are. I understand that you have been born at 1957, so you have been seeing a lot. You have been seeing the crash of the Eastern European walls, Cold War. But before you probably explain us if there had been some impacts on your life, who are you as a father, as a brother, as a husband?
Yeah, those might be the most important things as well. It's interesting thinking back. I mean, I was born in Washington, D.C., and so I think that's probably a bit indicative of my interest in politics and international affairs, because you can't grow up in Washington, D.C. without that being, in essence, part of your DNA. I remember as a young boy, my father was a lawyer, and so I think that probably helped me understand what law was. My mother was a teacher, English teacher as well, and I had four other siblings. Two, unfortunately, have passed away recently, so that's been a bit of a journey for me. And one of them is a twin brother who's a Broadway and television director. So I've always enjoyed experiencing that part.
If you have a twin brother, how did you get along, and how did it come that you went the way your father probably showed
right.
you, and he went another way, being a famous stage director and actor, and not only on theater but on Broadway, but also doing films.
Yeah.
So that was it an inspiration to each other, or was it just rather repulsion that you said, no, I don't want to be too creative?
No, I think it's interesting, because those who have experienced this magical aspect of life through having a twin, I've always felt it's only they that can understand how close you become as twin brothers. And so I was always so supportive of everything he did, and he showed his talent quite early in life. And so I just embraced that, and I have loved watching him achieve that. I suspect he might say the same for me, but I think we've always supported each other, and that support has always been there. I talk to him every day. I've talked to him every day for, I think, my entire life, or since I was able to get on a phone. We speak every single day.
And that's very, very nice, and it shows that the ties are there. I also had the pleasure to share with you once in a while stories about the family, and you shared with me that you have a son where you're very proud of. As we want to get to know you, you don't have to reflect on your private life, but it would be nice to see what inspires you when you look at your son, and what probably you also want to pass on to him.
Yeah, you're right. I have a 14-year-old son, Andrew, and so by the very fact that he's 14 means that I did this later in my life, and it's been just a joy, a real wonderful journey for me. When he was born, I remember thinking that I was just going to focus on each day with him, that I was never going to think or say to myself, oh, I can't wait until he gets older, or oh, I wish he would have been young again. It was just every single day in the moment, and I've lived by that. And so therefore I think the journey that he and I have had together as father and son has been just a joyful one. So yeah, I'm enjoying every moment of it.
Did your profession led to the fact that you decided to have later, like many lawyers, experiences a family, or was it maybe also a fear of the responsibility of being a father, which is probably not as controllable? I have three, as you know.
Yes.
As maybe being the lawyer or being the academic.
Yeah, it's a great question. Probably a little bit of both. There's always different apprehension, I think, in taking that big step, as any father or mother would know, in raising a child, although, again, it's been a joy for me. But I think the other part you mentioned is, I've been on a journey, professional journey, that has taken me around the world and several times in intense situations, and I'm passionate about what I do. And so, yes, I think that was part of it as well. I was just on that journey. So it's a real joy now to be in a time in my life when I'm able to do both. And every parent knows that it's a constant balance. You know that, but you just somehow get through it. So it's been good.
Well, thank you very much for having this glimpse in your private life for us all. Mm-hmm. Now, Mark, at a certain moment, one decides what one studies, where mm-hmm. the orientation goes. And obviously, you're inspired by your surroundings, friends, family, mm-hmm. Fathers, yeah. mothers. Why did you choose to become a lawyer? Was it because you were not able and very good in mathematics and you had to choose something, or was it really already as a young man somehow your dream?
Yeah, it's another great question. I think I was always drawn to the law. Growing up in Washington, D.C., that's a component of living in that. As I say, my father was a lawyer. But I think it was drawn at a time when I was living in D.C., the civil rights movement was at its height. And so you lived that every single day, actually, and in D.C. particularly. And that resonated to me at a very, very young age.
Why?
Because I was trying to understand the inequalities that existed between people, and the only difference was the color of their skin. And even as a young age, I was struggled with that. I didn't understand that. I remember my mother took my brother, Scott, my twin brother, and we were in fourth grade, and she took us to a movie called In the Heat of the Night. It was with Sidney Poitier. Mm-hmm. And it was one of these transformative moments for me. One, we were quite young, and so being taken to a movie of at that level, of that maturity, we felt that as well. But I remember, even today, I remember in that theater and watching this movie, and of course that is at the heart of a civil rights movement and discrimination, and that moved me greatly on that.
And as you then turned to studies, why did you choose up criminal law? And because that was the basis of your father development, and we now see Mark Ellis, executive director, was having to cater to all issues from criminal law, human rights law, but to run a great organization. How did that come about?
Yeah. And it was a good point, because it was not criminal law at the start. My life and my professional life had absolutely nothing to do with criminal law. Okay. I had a degree. When I went to college, I had a degree in economics. I then was fortunate to get a Fulbright scholarship, you mentioned, to the former Yugoslavia. That was in economics. That was on trade matters that I focused on. When I came back, I went to Washington, D.C. and joined a law firm. That law firm focused on one thing, trade, issues of trade between countries. That's what I did. I then worked as a consultant with the World Bank on what? Trade. Foreign investment, trade. That was all it was. And I was very happy doing that. The transformation occurred in the former Yugoslavia, a place that I spent 3 years on the Fulbright scholarship. And then when the war broke out, I was drawn back into the former Yugoslavia for a number of reasons. And it was then during the war that I started shifting my focus on rule of law issues and criminal law issues. And then when the Tribunal of Yugoslavia was created, that then really did shift me fairly dramatically into the area of criminal law. So actually it came later in my life, but I'm very happy that I had that background on commercial law, on rule of law, foreign investment areas, and that certainly has helped me here at the IBA, because as you say, there's lots of different areas of focus, and I feel I can understand talking about antitrust, talking about economic issues, as I can talking about criminal law.
Now, I think the majority, at least, of the members of the International Bar Association probably associate you, like I do, for your human rights activities and criminal law. So this aspect is very interesting. Maybe we can linger on this a little bit. Having this background obviously enables you to understand, but why did you change, and why do you believe people see you more as a human rights lawyer, yes, also sometimes label you? I want to understand, because I want to try to find out what was really those decisive moments in your career where you probably also made a conscious or unconscious decision to change the focus.
I don't mind that people see me more within the IBA particularly. I guess they see me more in this rule of law human rights area, and I knew that pretty early on. Part of that reason, it was a decision that I had made. I came into an organization, the International Bar Association, that has the best and most talented commercial lawyers in the world, without doubt, in every area of practice. So could I contribute to that? Yes, I suspect I contribute to that. Would that be my comparative advantage as being the director? Probably not, because I have the best there doing that. But I do understand it. So for me to be able to speak about with commercial lawyers about any array of areas.
Sorry, Mark, to interrupt you. I'm honestly not so much interested in you as executive director. That's, we know. I'm interested in what made you shift from this commercial lawyer, from this trained Washington DC trade agreement focused personality, to somebody who stands up like you did this morning in your statement for the rule of law, for the basic principles of profession. Because I would like to understand what inspired you.
I know exactly when it happened. I know when the transformation happened for me. It happened in Sarajevo during the war when I was there. That is when it worked. That's when it transformed for me, because I was in the, it was the latter part of the war, but nonetheless, it was a war. I was there assisting in some of the transformation that was about to take place, hopefully that was going to take place after the Dayton Accords. But I would sit in my hotel, the Holiday Inn in Sarajevo, that was darkened because there was a mandatory blackout at night, and I would watch tracer bullets moving across. And then when I would leave for meetings in the morning, you'd have to crouch down in order to move in parallel with any truck or tram that was going by so that you wouldn't get shot by Serbian military on the mountains. That's what I did. And then in the evening, when I was coming home from a meeting and I came out late, and it was again a mandatory blackout, I got lost trying to get back to the Sarajevo, to the Holiday Inn. And it was pitch, pitch dark. And I was walking, and the light from the moon appeared just for a small bit, but it was enough for me to figure out where I was. But where I was on a top of a hill that when I looked down, all you could see were grave sites, and they were freshly dug grave sites. This was the war that was going on. These were the atrocities that we were being committed. It was being committed in a country that I had spent 3 years in. That transformed me. That was the switch to moving into focusing on accountability, on justice. And soon after that, working with the tribunal that was emerged, that had been created. So that was the switch.
So Mark, thank you also for sharing your experience in the Kosovo, but I know that you have been in Berlin. Mm. I'm a German. I was there also when the wall came down, going even to the Nuremberg event on the first anniversary. Still, the wall was around the Brandenburger Gate. That's also very impactful on your life.
Yeah, that's something I'm delighted that you and I share, because that that was another transformative time in my life that I think really defined me. And I was in East Berlin, not knowing this, in the exact week that the wall fell. And I was there giving a series of lectures supported by the United States on economic issues on that to graduate students. And I remember as things began to unwind there, that you began to see people in cars being moving over to West Berlin. And I remember Gunter Schabowski, the head of the Communist Party in East Berlin, had unwittingly said the Berlin Wall was open up. And that then was quite remarkable. And I can assure you that students then had no interest in listening to me. And so that next morning, it was a Saturday morning, I went over and very early, and I took at the Bahnhof station there that was nearby, took the little train over to West Berlin, and I got out. And again, it was quite early. And there were already cracks appearing in the wall on the West Berlin side. And I remember peering through, and as you know, there's no man's land, and there were East German guards still patrolling that. And somehow I got the attention of one of the guards, and he came over. Unlike you, I did not speak German, but I was able to communicate with him. And I motioned for him to give me his hat, and I slipped him a $10 bill, which back in 1989
was a lot of money.
Was a heck of a lot of money for East Europe. And he did, and I have it on my desk. And his name is still on it. And he passed that over to me. And I wonder today, he was about my age, and I wonder today how his life turned out. But that to me was witnessing an ideological shift in world affairs and certainly in Europe. It was transformative. It was, I think Paul Krugman said, one of history's miracles. And that was a huge impact for me, and something that I have always remembered, and something that drives me as to the struggle of people and the willingness to fight for freedom. And of course, we're seeing that right now in Ukraine as well.
Very interesting, and I cannot agree more. And I think this also shows the dangers for the rule of law. Yeah. So thank you for sharing also this moment with us.
You're welcome.
As you know, we ask some of the people listening, hopefully, to us to have questions. And in this regard, there was one question probably touching this point. Do you have the feeling that as a lawyer and as to become what you have been achieving, you need once in a while, somebody asked, to make tough decisions, maybe also against your own economical or personal interest, to stand up for the rule of law?
Yeah, I think this gets back to part of the profession we're in. I've always felt that the legal profession is a noble profession. I see it that way. I see it that way regardless of whether a lawyer is practicing antitrust law, entertainment law, intellectual property law. It doesn't matter. We've entered into a profession that at its base, at its soul, is about justice. It's about equality. Everything that has changed that is right about principles is done through law. So therefore, every lawyer in this profession, I believe, has responsibility to speak out as a lawyer, regardless of his or her own background and what they do professionally. But as a lawyer, they have a responsibility to speak out on these principled issues. That's what I've tried to do all my life. And it's an easy, if you think about it that way, it's a fairly easy road to go. It's not, it has challenges, but if you stick with this idea that we have a responsibility to speak out on injustices, to support those that have been lost in this array of what we call the world, I think it can become quite easy, actually.
Well, now we are already in a section I've prepared, which is probably having a subtitle of the untold stories, and you shared one of your decisive moments. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that you also experienced failures, moments where you tried, where you probably had aspirations, and at the end of the day, you turned around, you said, this didn't function. Maybe you can share some which inspire people not to give up, and probably also let us know what you've done, be it when you were alone in your room after failure, to carry on.
I look at life, have always looked at life, at the moment in front of you and what I'm going to do tomorrow. I have rarely looked back in the past to assess successes or failures, actually, because oftentimes I'm not sure why I would do that. Those things happen, successes happen, failures happen, failures certainly happen, and that's something people will just accept. The key here is not to be defined by those, by failures or challenges. I've always thought that those types of challenges make you better. And in the end, you think at the moment that is a real failure. I remember one sitting in a room, because I had applied.
I was about to ask.
Yeah, my focus was after college, when I decided to go to law school. There was one law school I wanted to attend. I won't tell you what it is, but there was one law school on my mind. And I was darn certain I was going to make that I was going to be accepted in that law school. I had already kind of projected out what I was going to do and how it was going to be, where I was going to be. And I didn't get accepted. And that was a bit of a shock for me. And a real disappointment, real disappointment. I was disappointed about myself because I thought, well, are there things that I should have done, I didn't do? And then I accepted where I had been accepted somewhere else, at Florida State University, a great university, actually, because I'd been there at the university. And that changed everything. That I can't imagine, I wouldn't be here where I am right now had I not been at Florida State University. Now, who knows where I had been if I had gone to the other law school? I don't know. But the only point I have is, well, was that journey a great journey for me? And it has been a wonderful journey. And it was because I went to another law school. I went to law school that I didn't think, it's not the law school I wanted to go to. So that's what I say about accepting that there are going to be failures, but just kind of moving on and focusing on right now what's happening. What can I do today? What can I do tomorrow?
Now, sorry to interrupt. People probably could interpret this as a certain arrogance, not looking back. I know you, and you're not an arrogant person. But still, let's linger on that point a little bit. When you say, I'm looking ahead, you still are defined by what you did and who surrounded you before. Maybe you can try to explain to the audience, especially maybe younger colleagues who are still on the way, this concept of looking ahead. Yeah. Because I think it's probably one of the drivers and gives you the energy doing what you do.
No question. I wake up every morning, and I have always in my entire life, I wake up every morning saying, what can I do today? What can I do today to make it a little better? Not just for me, but what can I do to make it a little better for everything else, for everyone else? And that's what drives me. This journey we're on, that's how fast that goes. I'm not going to waste my time on reassessing, getting upset about something that happened in the past. That has happened, and I accept it, and then I got to move on, because the impact I'm going to make, the impact any person is going to make, is right now, today and tomorrow. That's what you're going to make your impact. So that's what I'm going to focus on. And that's what drives me.
If you have those drivers, and I think many of us can relate to that, what are the Mark Ellis dreams, and where do you want to still go for? What are your visions? Where do you believe, looking back as a person who is not at the beginning of his journey,
right,
but in the middle, what do you still want to achieve? Where do you think the future will see Mark Ellis?
Well, that's a tough question too, because I think that also depends on how one projects one's life and how you approach that. There will be people in the audience that will have set out, because I remember quite young having set out, well, what's your 5-year plan? What's your 10-year plan? And I don't criticize that. I know friends that do that and they set it out. I've never done it. It's never been part of the process that I go. So you say now, well, what are your bigger plans? I don't know what those are, because it gets back to what I said earlier. I live what is in front of me today and what I think we can do tomorrow. And that's oftentimes driven by the circumstances that we face. And for me, the most important thing is to react, to respond to those circumstances, not to turn away from an injustice, not to turn away from an opportunity to make an impact, but just do it. So I can't tell you what it is. I can tell you, though, that the passion, the dream that I have, and I suspect so many people have, is to say, when I'm faced with those circumstances, when I'm faced with those challenges, when I'm faced with a request to do something, I need to do it. That's what drives me.
But Mark, you studied economics, as you said, mm-hmm. and then law. You are still executive director, and you still have to inspire your people around you. You have to run a big organization. Yeah. And therefore, there must be visions. And maybe you can tell the audience, because we understand now, I think, the way you act better, but how they can make a difference, what you would believe they can contribute, because you made this transition from economics into legal vocation, into law, into even rule of law, human rights, but still coming back as an executive director to your original training. What is the gist of it? Why? What do you believe makes an outstanding professional in our industry, in our legal profession? Mm-hmm. And how does that relate also to the structures we have in our profession, by bar associations and others?
Because we know each other well enough, you've known each other for many years, and you'll know one thing about me, which I think is somewhat defines me, is I don't like to spend a lot of time on the insignificant things, on the things that don't. I don't like the politics of things. I don't like the attempt to destroy people. I just don't like that. It's not where we should be. Think beyond that. Go beyond that and think about, getting back to what I said, that we have a short period of time here. And if we believe that one of our responsibilities, particularly as lawyers, is to make a difference, focus on making a difference. The rest of it is static to me. And that to me is, that's what should drive organizations. I think that's what the IBA is about. It's always moving towards what we can do to be the global voice of the legal profession. And it's what drives me as an individual. What can we do to make things better? That's
and
what it is.
What did you differently than others? Because not everybody is so exposed, is not sometimes also a controversial personality, because there are people who probably like you. You probably also encountered people who were disagreeing with you. Yeah. So what did you do differently?
Well, maybe I was lucky. I think that's part of life. Sure. I don't think I've done anything different from that many people do. I'm inspired by people all the time but I'm inspired by them because of the principal stances that they make, the willingness to lose everything because of that passion they have on issues of equality, justice, on that. I think I'm doggedly principled. I think I'm honest. I speak out in a forthright way. I might offend people. I get that. But no one can question my sincerity, trustworthiness, and principled position. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that makes me different from a lot of people that I'm inspired by, but that's what defines me. And by doing so, not everyone's going to agree with that. I get that. But in the end, I have to wake up and say, was that the right thing to do? Like this morning with the op-ed piece, was that the right thing to do to speak out, even though there'll be people that might disagree? Certainly my Russian friends will disagree, but I feel comfortable saying this thing, and I say that, and I do that often.
So if I understand you, say, don't be afraid of being yourself.
Definitely don't be afraid of being yourself. Yeah, don't be afraid of being yourself.
Now, as we promised that this Who Am I series will be short, precise, and also taking consideration questions. There was a question obviously triggered by the Ukrainian war and the crisis and the attacks on the rule of law associated with that, by somebody who asked, what challenges do you foresee for the future for the legal profession, mm-hmm. especially also with a possibility or not possibility to bring those atrocities to justice, and still also balance between the ones responsible and the ones who probably are themselves victims, because we all know and have a lot of Russian colleagues who are speaking up and who are also standing up for their beliefs, mm-hmm. but have probably not the possibility to be seen or embracing this. So what challenges do you foresee for the legal profession, and what would be the wishes you would like one day the next generations, the young generations, to pursue?
Well, I think the most compelling challenge that we are facing today in the world that's particularly important for the legal profession is the rise of nationalism and populism. And they're different, but I always see them kind of two sides of the same coin. But that's what we're witnessing time and time again in today's. And Russia and the military attack on Ukraine personifies this nationalistic fervor that exists in Russia. It's not the only place it exists. It exists in other countries, particularly, as we know, in Europe. That for me, is our greatest challenge. How do we begin to reverse this rise of populism and nationalism that is so destructive and soul-destroying? And this, to me, is a challenge. And this is where I think lawyers can play such an important role on that, because everything that nationalism stands for, everything that this populism stands for, it is opposite of what we as lawyers embrace, what we hold dear to our profession and to ourselves. And that's why I think the voice of the legal profession on this is going to be absolutely essential. And we've got to figure out new ways of doing it and new ways of countering it. Because if not, we'll see what's happening in Russia and elsewhere, as we've been witnessing, including the United States under the Trump administration. We're going to see destruction at levels we've never seen before since probably World War II.
Maybe one aspect here, because we are back at the organization you have been leading since so many years, yeah. as an executive director, it's the International Bar Association.
Yeah.
Maybe one, two words of your perspective, how the bar associations play in this regard, because obviously we both agree that they are very important to defend the rule of law. Is there any vision, any aspiration you have for them?
Yeah, that's it, though. You said, Jörg, exactly what the main focus should be, defending the rule of law. If a bar association did nothing else other than to speak out and defend the rule of law, under the circumstances we're facing now in the world, That would be a grand gesture. That would be so important. So for me, the shift for bar associations, the shift for the legal community at large should be about the rule of law. That's what it needs to happen. And the legal profession can position itself as truly the voice in promoting and advocating and protecting the rule of law. And that to me is the most important responsibility that we have right now as part of the legal profession.
Well, we are slowly coming to an end, Mark. I think all your comments are well received and well understood. I really like this notion of standing up for the rule of law and to understand the vocation we all have as lawyers. Is there any concluding message, any wisdom, any mantra you would like to pass on, which probably will be the gist of your life and your extraordinary life journey as a lawyer?
One, because I thought this might come up, there's two parts of that. One, I've always lived my life it's a 50-50 principle for me. So 50% of life should be enjoying life, because you've been given a God-presented gift to enjoy life, and there's lots of things out in that diversity. 50% of it should be making it better. And if you live your life that way, I think it should be, for me, it's a fulfilling life. But the last point of that was, I thought about that in relations to Andrew.
Andrew is your son.
My son. Mm-hmm. So I wrote him a letter, which he will get when I die, but it sets out my thoughts about a lot of things. But in the end, I wrote something that I leave it at the end with something that I think represents me, and I hoped him, and I
please,
printed it.
If
and,
you want to share it now,
and I printed
it's a
I will. I
don't
know, but he's not going to see this. He'll see it when I go. So this is what I say to him at the end of my letter for him when I go. So he'll receive this when I die. I say, so go live life fully. Make it bigger than yourself. Embrace new ideas. Experience new things. Be open to taking risks. Be open to showing vulnerability. Try not to be pressured to follow the crowd. This is not always easy to do, but it will help if you surround yourself with people and friends who are willing to take unpopular stands and make courageous decisions. Never shy away from speaking out forcefully against injustices. Be willing to be extraordinary when those around you are not. And along the way, try to make a difference. Leave the world a bit better off than when you came into it on that magical day of March 11th, 2008. Thank you for being my son, Andrew. I love you always.
Thank you very much for sharing this with us. I think more doesn't need to be said about Mark Ellis, his life journey, and who he really is. I thank you for looking at this edition. More will be coming. We will have editions covering all the continents of this world and different great examples of the legal profession. And I'm very happy that we started with you, Mark, and that you shared so much of your dreams and your vocation and your private input. So thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you, Jörg, for having me. Thank you.